In this episode, the Ninth Circuit hears Guzman Lopez versus Blanche. The petition concerns asylum, withholding of removal, and protection under the Convention Against Torture. The argument focuses on the claimed particular social group, the required link between that group and persecution, and whether the immigration judge used the correct specific intent analysis for CAT.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Cody Cahoe, and I represent petitioners. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. If I can, I'll keep an eye on the clock. I'd like to spend most of this morning, Your Honor, talking about the asylum claim, which I think has a little bit more meat to it. But I want to start with the CAT claim, if I may, because I think it's an exceptionally easy case for this court to remand. The BIA in this case said that it was affirming for the reasons stated by the IJ.
The BIA is the Board of Immigration Appeals, which reviews immigration judges' decisions. The IJ is the immigration judge who conducts the immigration court proceeding.
And the IJ, in turn, said that it was concluding, and this was the only basis for its holding, that there was no specific intent to commit torture, that is, specific intent to cause severe pain or suffering, because the underlying motivation of the gang in this case was to extort the petitioner to obtain money and greater power. That is just a plain misapplication of the law as stated in the CAT implementing regulations. Torture is defined under the regulations as the intentional infliction of severe pain or suffering for such purposes as intimidating or coercing the victim, punishing the victim, discrimination of any kind. That is, the regulations anticipate there will be some kind of underlying motivation aside from the torturer waking up and saying, I think I'd like to torture someone today. That was the reasoning behind the IJ's decision, and that can't...
So, counsel, let me ask you. I don't know how the IJ could have decided what the motivation was of the gang members who beat your client. So I think that your point is very well made. Now the IJ says that your client didn't carry the burden of proof, and I don't know if there's some additional layer there. In other words, what does she have to prove in order to prove that they acted with specific intent? That's a very, very demanding standard that the government has if it has to prove, you know, for example, you know, tax fraud or something like that. It's a very hard standard to meet and sort of deliberately. If the burden shifts to her to prove that they acted with specific intent, what does she have to show? I agree with your point that there's no evidence here. We don't really know what their motivation is. Nobody asked them. Nobody said we're gonna beat you until you suffer severe pain so that you'll give us money. But if it's on a burden of proof question, what does she have to show?
I have two responses to that, Judge Bybee. The first is that I don't know that the court even needs to get to that, because what the record shows here is that the agency just applied the wrong rule of law. And when the agency misreads and misapplies its own regulations, for instance, by saying that having an underlying motivation is inconsistent as a matter of law with having the specific intent to cause severe pain or suffering, I really think that's all that you need to say.
But if in fact there aren't facts that would show what she would have alleged or what she did allege, wouldn't we have an issue of whether or not it was harmless error? Did she allege enough?
I don't think, say that there was harmless error here, Your Honor, because the agency's reasoning has to stand or fall. The decision has to stand or fall based on the reasons that the agency gave. And here, and this is the government's position as well, this was the only reason that the agency provided. So this court can't speculate. But I do want to acknowledge that, obviously, courts are making the determination about what the intent was in any given case. And I think that usually it's just a result of, well, what is it that they did or threatened to do? And here, all the evidence in the record says that it's uncontradicted that she was beaten no fewer than 5 times.
So that's undisputed.
I believe that's undisputed. The IJ found her to be credible, and the BIA didn't dispute that conclusion. But then, in addition to being beaten, she was threatened with being raped, forced into prostitution, or killed. And I think there's no question under this court's case law that those actions are intended to inflict severe pain or suffering and would constitute torture if carried out.
So the government seems to pivot a little bit in the briefing and says, well, the harm didn't rise to the level of torture, which is not something the agency said directly, but or maybe that's your position on that.
I don't think they said that at all. No, I think that the IJ's decision is quite clear. It's one page on page 62 of the record that I'm finding. Here's the standard. You have to find specific intent, cites Villegas v. Mukasey, and then says in a couple of sentences, I don't think there was specific intent because the physical violence was just the unfortunate consequence of the intent of the goal to extort the petitioner.
Let's move to the go ahead, please.
No. It's all right.
I was going to move to the asylum and withholding, but if you want to continue on, Kat.
I was just going to say, so what you're saying is that in the opinion itself, the court says, as an undisputed fact, that she was abused or she was tortured or what was the language you said, so that that's enough on the facts to establish that if they had applied the right law, there would be no question that she had met the burden.
But I wouldn't say that she needs to find that if the application of the law were correct, then the result would be different, because I think that that's something this court needs to remand for. But the immigration judge did find that there was past persecution. She didn't say one way or another whether there was past torture, because again, she decided.
But that's undisputed fact.
What
in this case?
I don't want to speak for the government. I think it's undisputed that she suffered these beatings and that the agency found her credible as to all of her testimony. I want to acknowledge the government cites cases where past beatings alone did not necessarily rise to the level of torture. Again, I think that's something that the agency needs to figure out on remand, applying the correct legal standard. But I think we explain in our reply brief why those cases tend to deal just with past beatings and not with, I think, credible future threats of rape, forced prostitution, and death, where the court has generally found a greater than 50% chance of future torture. Judge Bress, you
say? Yeah, well, so let's turn to the asylum and withholding. It seems like you have kind of two issues here, or maybe problems. One, what is the particular social group, and is it changing over the course of, you know, what we saw before the agency and now? And then second, what about the agency's no nexus finding? And why isn't that supported by substantial evidence?
A particular social group must share a characteristic its members cannot, or should not be required to, change. It must also have clear boundaries and be socially distinct in the relevant society. A separate preservation rule generally requires the claim to be presented clearly enough to the immigration agency before a court reviews it.
That's just where I was going to go, Your Honor. And starting with that first issue, I think you just need to look at cases like Antonio against Garland, and Rios against Lynch, Silvestre Mendoza, which I acknowledge is an unpublished opinion. But all of those cases stand for the proposition that where the petitioner reasonably proposed one group, where that group clearly runs throughout the case, is the heart of the claim, the gravamen of the claim, to use the language from those decisions. Then this court has said the agency, if it doesn't acknowledge that that is the group, has applied its analysis to the wrong social group, and we must remand.
Right, but I mean, why isn't this asking for the BIA essentially to perform the work of a lawyer to come up with arguments that the petitioner could come up with?
I think, first of all, I don't think this is any different from Antonio, where, again, the category that the petitioner's counsel there proposed to the BIA was, I believe, women who are punished because they're seen as a bad influence because they dress as men. And this court said, look, we're looking at the record here. It's clear that what her argument was throughout that case was that she was perceived to be a lesbian. And I don't think that there would be any greater, I think there would be less rewriting of the definition, the proposed social group in this case, because here, being a woman was sort of the critical central element of both of the categories.
But was this even presented to the BIA to say, listen, we have this big, long, particular social group, but we think you should now kind of take out isolated pieces of this and go with that?
I think it was sufficiently presented for the BIA to rule on it, Your Honor. On pages 14 to 15 of the record, which is her BIA brief, she says, and she says this multiple times in the BIA brief, that the group is based on gender and nationality.
But it seems like she described the social group in all kinds of different ways, too.
I'm looking at page 14. That would be the AR 21.
I beg your pardon. I meant AR 14 to 15.
Do you want the AR or you want the, I'm looking at page 14 of the brief.
Oh, of the brief.
Of the brief, which is,
oh, okay.
Which is, AR, I think 21, here. I believe this is what I've got is the brief.
You're right.
Young Guatemalan women who are then distinguished by age, appearance, and sex, who've been beaten and are unprotected by government authorities, who resisted further extortion attempts by gang members is a past act that can form the base of a particular social group. So is that not the group? Or what do you think the group is?
I don't dispute that that was what her counsel said to the agency. Her counsel also said repeatedly that the group was based on her gender and nationality, and the entire.
Oh, I don't see that in this.
I think it's just, and this is why we discussed Diaz Reynoso in our case, that if you just sort of were to imagine out the all of these sort of circular, I think, material about this is women who are punished because of social conditions and the government.
But you're asking us to reform the PSG. This is a problem. If they propose a PSG and it is circular, that creates particular problems for the agency, which is tried to deal with. And our cases have said you can't knock it out just because it's circular. But there are some limitations there. And so what do you think the PSG is, and where can you point us that they articulated that PSG?
The PSG, I would say that the agency should have discussed.
No, I want to know what PSG she proposed. No, I don't, not what the agency should have talked about. I want to know what the lawyer for your client told the agency.
So you're not mischaracterizing her brief, Your Honor. It does say all of that, but it also says based on her gender and nationality.
Okay, and where is that? Can you give me the page on that one?
Yes, that's if you look at page 14 to 15 of the AR. So that's page 7 to 8 of the brief. 7, he says, linked to their membership in a social group defined by the characteristics of gender and nationality. Page 17 of the AR, young women and their status in Guatemalan society made them easy pickings. Cites Perdomo versus Holder again and again in the brief, which again is a case specifically about this court considering women in Guatemala as a particular social group. And Antonio.
Okay, so what, as we sit here now, what PSG do you think she's presented to the agency? I'm not sure that the statement on 14, you know, does very much when the statement later on page 21 seems far more detailed and far more presented to the agency.
Your Honor,
if we just did a word search and found that she somewhere mentioned ethnicity and or gender and nationality, I'm not sure that gives her a PSG.
I think the group that we would ask this court to send it back to the agency for is women in Guatemala. And I do just want to stress that I think Antonio dealt with exactly this situation. And it acknowledged in a footnote that the petitioner there could have been clearer in all of her presentations and that the group evolved somewhat over time. There's a footnote that describes verbatim what the petitioner's
okay,
counsel
can,
there.
Can you point to us any place in here where she said women in Guatemala is my PSG? As opposed to adding all of these other qualifications, because all of the qualifications there, she's got something about gender and nationality in there, but a whole bunch of other things as well. But what's the agency supposed to do?
I think the agency in this case, Your Honor, just needs to look at the entire record and all of the country conditions evidence in this case.
That won't describe a PSG. That's not exhaustion of a PSG counsel. That's not going to fly with me. I won't speak for my colleagues, but you're going to lose me really fast.
I would urge you to consider Antonio, Your Honor. I do think
okay,
that
it's. But Antonio is a case. Do you have any place in the briefing to the agency that you can tell us where she succinctly said, this is my PSG?
I would acknowledge that a lot of times it has other fluff appended to the end of it. I do think that on page 14, saying defined by characteristics of gender and nationality is pretty darn close to what you're asking for.
It's debatable what this would even get you anyway, because the PSG you're proposing is probably not cognizable anyway, at least for purpose too broad, you know, and that's probably why extensive efforts were made below to try to narrow it in some way, because if you extrapolate it out and go with the high level points you're making, you run into some other problems under the case law. But even aside from all this, and don't worry about the clock, we'll give you your rebuttal time. The nexus piece of this, you know, there's a finding under both the one central reason and the A reason standards that this was general criminality. Why isn't that supported by substantial evidence?
Nexus means the required link between persecution and a protected ground. For asylum, that ground must be at least one central reason. Under Ninth Circuit law, withholding requires only that it be a reason, although withholding demands a higher likelihood of persecution.
So I would, if I could just comment on the legal standard question as well, and on route to answering that question, which is that we think that the agency's reasoning, which is pretty sparse here, suggests that it was applying or viewing this case as a binary rather than a mixed motive analysis. When it said that it was not finding that that the motivation was her gender or her particular social group, because instead the relevant consideration was the motive to gain
money
and power.
Does this whole argument of yours turn on this one word instead?
I think that it would be one thing if you had a more extensive analysis from the agency that made it clearer than I think the BIA's decision does, that it was not taking a binary analysis. But when you have essentially one sentence of relevant analysis, and it does use that terminology, which seems, I think, pretty indicative of using a binary analysis, I think it's at least very difficult to say if the BIA was applying a correct mixed motive analysis or a binary analysis. But I do want to address your question about substantial evidence. And here I think you have to acknowledge, and we point to cases on page 16 of our reply brief, that where the punishment gets more intense or severe, or where certain punishments are reserved for certain people, that is sufficient at least to show that the prohibited motivation was a factor, if not a central factor. And so if persecutors said, like, sure, we start extorting everybody, but when we find out you're an Episcopalian, then we hang you by meat hooks, or if you're a socialist, then we use thumbscrews on you. That's enough, I think.
If you lose on the new PSG argument, does the court need to reach this issue of the nexus finding, or is that the end of the claim?
No, I think that even if you were to only evaluate the two particular social groups that the BIA ruled, we would still argue that the nexus application was wrong as a matter of law because it applied a binary application, and that the record evidence here shows that she was targeted and her persecution made worse because she was a woman.
Why don't we have you take a seat? We'll hear from your opposing counsel. We'll put 2 minutes on the clock for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Morning. Michael Velchik for the United States Attorney General. I just want to offer one comment directly responsive to the last colloquy on the particular social group. The chief argument has been that this court should recognize a third particular social group. If you look at the administrative record, page 142 in the brief before the immigration judge, petitioner says they only offered one particular social group. At the hearing before the immigration judge, this is at the administrative record, page 94, the immigration judge specifically asked counsel who represented petitioner, are there any other PSGs? Quote, no, Your Honor. Petitioners invoke Diaz-Reynoso. That case does not stand for the proposition for which petitioner cites it. The comment that I want to offer the court is, even if, for whatever reason, this court reads that decision or any other legal authority to require an immigration judge to rewrite an initial proposed PSG, or to identify the lowest common denominator, or to winnow through a list of dependent clauses to identify the combination of characteristics that would give that particular petitioner the greatest chances of success on the merits. That's in effect what the immigration judge did when he considered sua sponte a second group, young women. What petitioner is asking for is not a rewrite. Petitioner is asking for a rewrite of the rewrite. We respectfully submit that a waiver and forfeiture are not so elastic. And to the last colloquy, I do want to emphasize that it's the government's position that any remand on this issue would be futile for both factual and legal reasons. As a factual matter, the board rests its decision on nexus, but even if it had to conduct that review again, on this record, I refer the court to AR 125 to 126, where the immigration judge specifically asked petitioner whether or not the gangs discriminated against men versus women. She responded, no, and I think that would be dispositive on the nexus analysis. And
the petitioner says, well, yes, I mean, there's a general criminality here, but there's worse criminality against women. So why is that not a mixed motive?
I think for the same reasons in Rodriguez-Zuniga. I mean, no one's discounting the possibility that in theory someone could show mixed motives. But on this particular fact pattern, she found that it was not a reason at all, not even a central reason. And I think the fact pattern in Rodriguez-Zuniga is quite on point. And to be perfectly frank, I think the facts there are pretty egregious, and I think more so. At least there, the petitioner there could point to the fact that her cousin and cousin's child were murdered, whereas here there was just specific criminality. And I would emphasize that in her own declarations, every time she tells her own story, she always begins with, because she couldn't pay the money. She was the only one that had trouble meeting the quota. Every single time she references, it's always about the money. It's about the money. The case is about
the money.
But
she also references, it's also because I'm female, right? And then she's threatened with prostitution as well. So what do you make of those pieces of this?
So with respect to the first, again, I would say that she gave specific testimony to the immigration judge that the gangs did not discriminate against men versus women. With respect to threats of prostitution, I still think it's true that the gang, the record supports, or at least there's substantial evidence in the record to support, targeted everyone who could pay money or who wasn't paying their quotas. Now, they may articulate their threats to particular individuals that might be gender-specific or age-specific or specific to anyone's particular conditions. And so maybe they vocalize those threats to women in one way and they threaten men another way. But I think that doesn't change the fact that the record, substantial evidence in the record shows that it was not a reason at all.
Well, when you have substantial evidence in the record, you can look at the substantial evidence in terms of what was found by the AIA. And so I'm looking at that and see if there is the possibility that there wasn't substantial evidence based upon what the petitioner alleged and set forth in court. So as a matter of law, we're looking at the record. You're asking us to say that the finding is supported by substantial evidence. Why?
It is supported by substantial evidence, and we would also emphasize the Supreme Court's recent decision.
Well, what substantial evidence supports it? And it has to be undisputed is what we're, as long as it's undisputed, we'll consider that.
Yeah,
but if it's disputed, then there's a question about credibility, that type of thing. Because the word substantial evidence has a lot of different meanings in this context.
Within the administrative record, I would refer the court to her own declaration at 195 to 196. I would also refer the court to her colloquy and testimony before the immigration judge, starting at page 120 to 126. I think those are the best sites to look to in the first instance. But as a legal matter, I think we would emphasize, and we have a strong interest in the government in emphasizing, that substantial evidence is quite deferential. No reasonable adjudicator could come to a contrary conclusion, and the Supreme Court just reaffirmed this high threshold in Urias Ayana. So that's our position.
How about Kat? Because, you know, your opposing counsel began there, I think, wisely, because this is probably the weakest part of the decision below from a legal standpoint.
So we think the Kat analysis is 100% right. I do think it's a bit nuanced, and I think all three questions spoke to some distinctions that are probably worth teasing out. The first is the standard and the burden of proof. I do think it is very important that petitioner does bear the burden. It is her burden to show that it's more likely than not that if in the future she is returned to Guatemala, that she will suffer torture.
Has the agency passed on that in any meaningful sense?
Yes, I believe the second sentence of the final paragraph of the BIA's decision said that she did not establish, which speaks to the burden of proof, that she had suffered past torture or was likely to suffer future torture when she returned to Guatemala. And so I know that you asked.
Yeah, I would feel better about that if the IJ had given us something more on that, but this is just a boilerplate statement.
Well, it incorporates by reference, the third sentence of the paragraph incorporates by reference the reasoning of the IJ. The IJ, I think quite wisely, decided to rest a decision on specific intent rather on other factors.
Right, but I mean, that reasoning seems pretty suspect, no?
No, not at all. I want to push back against that strongly. So,
counsel, as you get prepared to do that, I've reviewed, you know, hundreds of maybe thousands of BIA decisions, with a very high percentage of them dealing with CAT claims. I cannot remember another decision by an IJ that decided it on the basis of the specific intent. So this strikes me as very, very unusual. I don't know how the IJ, and this is why I asked the questions I did, I don't know how the IJ can determine off of this record that they did not have that specific intent. Now, whether she has borne her burden To prove that they did is a different, more complicated question. I think it adds an additional layer of complexity. It flips the role that the government usually has in criminal cases when it has to show specific intent. It's a very high burden for the government to meet in criminal cases.
So I think there are two critical legal conclusions that make this an easier case, and I think why the immigration judge decided to put it within this framework that the Ninth Circuit established in Mukasey. So as we've stated, the test is whether or not she can prove it's more likely than not in the future that she would suffer such.
And that's just a preponderance, not beyond a reasonable doubt or clear and convincing. Just over 50%. That's all she had to prove.
In the future. Her best evidence and her best argument was not about future conduct, but about past conduct. She pointed to specific beatings in the past. We provide context of this court's case law showing that we don't even think that would rise to the severity of torture. I think a different immigration judge.
If the IJ had decided that, we'd be having a very, very different discussion.
And that's why I wanted to raise it with you, is because we would be having a different conversation. We would be arguing about line drawing. Is 4 beatings, 5 beatings, 6 beatings enough? And then what about the future threats? Were those just conditional verbal threats, or would they actually follow through when she came back? I think that's a much harder and difficult conversation to have. But I think by grounding the decision in specific intent, saying, look, all we can say about their intent is that they did engage in these 5 beatings. Quite frankly, that wouldn't be severe enough.
But it was intent to harm. I mean, the intent comes up in the case law, in cases where, like, you have bad prison conditions or poverty, and then the argument is made that these conditions are, in effect, torture. And the response is, no, they're not. They're just poor conditions that may result in harm. There was no intent in the way we're talking about. The way intent is being used in the IJ decision is quite a bit different, though.
I don't think people should trivialize the reasoning of the IJ's judge to suggest that the particular gang members did not intend for their fists to leave their chest and to make physical contact and to impress upon the victim. Like, everyone acknowledges that there was that level of intent. One of the reasons why CAT has a high threshold is not only is it petitioner's burden, but there's also the specific intent requirement, which, as Mukasey goes through, was a very important reason for why it was ultimately adopted in the way that it was. And so if the best evidence that she has is that in the past she was subject to certain beatings that substantively wouldn't even matter, wouldn't even meet the standard of severe enough, I think that's pretty good proof that she cannot bear her burden to show that at least the past beatings
What evidence was there that was offered by the IJ that she didn't have specific intent that we need to look at so we can say that evidence makes more sense, she didn't meet her burden?
So in addition to the analysis of the past harms when she was beaten up allegedly 5 times, she also specifically asked and pointed to the testimony where petitioner spoke to why would she predict in the future upon return would she be subject to torture? And she said, because they would know that I'm coming back. And she found that to be inconsistent with the previous reasons given. It also wasn't consistent with some of the other declarations. And I don't think that.
So in that inconsistency was sufficient to not believe her. That she had the specific intent. They had the specific intent. That's all the BIA judge had to make.
I think there are 2 points to make. Number one is, regardless of whether or not she could establish past torture, even if she did, she was not able to make the connection to establish the likelihood of future torture, which is her burden to bear.
Okay, so what did she say to establish that you disagree with or you think that is contrary to what the government proved?
Well, not only is it – I mean, she didn't affirmatively give evidence or reason to think that
what,
when she
what
came
What kind
back,
of evidence? What if she says that, you mean all she did was give opinion evidence?
Well, I think it's her testimony. I might –
But what was her testimony that was not specific intent?
Her testimony, which she gave before the judge and which I believe the IJ quoted in the oral ruling, was that why do you think that, you know, when you go back, you would be subject to torture? And she did not give a convincing answer to the IJ. And I think
What did she say? That was not convincing? Because I agree with you that if we were to decide as a matter of law it was not convincing, she has a matter of burden.
If I remember the quotation, I think it was if I were to return, they would come after me because they know that I would be coming back or because I would be coming home.
And that's not enough. There was no controverting evidence that was offered by the government that was false.
Well, I mean, there was evidence that all of the previous torture, which she predicated her future predictions on, were not motivated by a specific intent to cause, like, severe harm sufficient to qualify for torture.
I guess we're getting so far outside what the IJ actually said. I mean, the IJ, as I read it, said they were really meaning to extort you, and in the process of that, they hurt you, but they hurt you because they were trying to extort you. Well, that doesn't sound like normal analysis for a CAT claim.
I mean, I do think it gets to our intuitions about, like, what is torture? I mean, the whole point of torture, at least in common parlance, is, you know, it's pain for the purpose of pain or something that's in addition to just purely instrumental.
No, but even the regs provide for the possibility that the reason that you intend to specifically intend to cause the pain and suffering is to extract a confession or to extract money or the location of somebody, whatever it might be.
Right. I mean, there's not some requirement that the pain be sadistic. You know, it can be for a means to some other end. I mean, the difficulty with this case, of course, is that she met the past persecution showing, which most petitioners do not meet. Whether she could meet the torture standard, which is higher, is an open question, and maybe you'll win on that later. But right now, we really don't have any examination of whether the harm, which rose to the level of persecution, was nonetheless not so bad that it didn't rise to the level of torture.
So I think you missed one, I guess, distinction that I'd want to emphasize is, yes, on remand, we could prevail on an argument that even though it rose to the level of persecution, it did not rise to the level of torture. And I think that that's, you know, a path to victory. But I also think on this record, and one way of conceptualizing the opinion is that even if she did suffer past persecution, she did not bear her burden of even showing for the past conduct that the gangs had intended to inflict that severe level of pain that is commensurate with torture. The sort of acts that they conducted, the lack of any lasting injuries, surgeries, none of that suggests that any member of the gangs actually intended to torture in the past.
I think your point is a fair one. What concerns me is that IJ says, you know, she testified the reason why they did this is because they wanted money. And the reason why they were making these comments and hurting her and beating her was because they were extorting her for money. And I agree that by itself doesn't seem to demonstrate specific intent. But the IJ makes an additional finding in the next sentence. He says, the reason why the gang did that, I don't know how the IJ can possibly draw that conclusion.
I think that's an overbroad objection. I mean, by that analysis, like, you could never make a nexus analysis. The whole point of the nexus analysis in the persecution context was, why are they doing this? What is the purpose? Is it general criminality, or is it because her membership in a PSG? And to the extent that courts can make legal conclusions and factual determinations, which are subject to...
But again, I'm telling you, this is the first case I can remember in 23 years where an IJ has gone down this route and said you didn't prove specific intent. And so that's why I'm so puzzled by this.
Well, I think the IJ is following this court's lead. It cited Mukasey for both of its decisions. It specifically cited Ninth Circuit precedent. It tried to follow as closely as possible Rodriguez-Zuniga for purposes of the nexus analysis. I think it tried to fall within this court's guidance in Mukasey. And I think that that's probably an easier way to determine this as opposed to trying to adjudicate how this compares to the severity of Ahmed and some of the other cases of, you know, 4 beatings, 5 beatings, brass knuckles, surgery, no surgery.
We've taken you just about to the end of your time. Let me see if we have any questions. Okay, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
I'll try to make 3 quick points, Your Honor. The first is, again, starting with the CAT claim. I just want to emphasize that I think the government's argument here is based on a rewriting of the IJ's opinion. The IJ never found that there was no past torture, and it did not find from a lack of past torture an unlikelihood of future torture. It ruled based solely, as you said, Judge Bress, on this notion that torture needs to be inherently and only sadistic and have only a sadistic purpose, no other purpose. And I just don't think that can be squared with the CAT regulations. And Judge Bybee, I've also never come across a case that seems to go off on these grounds that wasn't the kind of Villegas situation that Judge Bress mentioned. And then I'll just say, in the alternative, even if the BIA did purport to go off and rule on other bases like no past torture or no future acquiescence, that would be based on information that the IJ never found, facts that the IJ never found. And it would be completely contradictory with the BIA's statement that it was ruling for the reasons stated by the IJ. And I think in that situation, the result would have to be to remand at least for a clearer explanation so that this court could evaluate what the BIA was actually ruling based on. So back to the asylum claim. I just want to clarify, I don't think that our argument is that there was a third group that her counsel actually proposed that the IJ and the BIA never recognized. The argument is that this was the heart of her claim the entire time, that she was part of the category of women in Guatemala. And I acknowledge, Judge Bybee, that there is a lot of other language in the BIA brief and in the statements to the IJ around that. But I don't think that that prevented this court in cases like Antonio or Rios from saying, we think that you fairly proposed this other group, and this is what your group was the whole time, and we're going to send it back. And then I would just last emphasize that I think it's hard to say there was no reason at all linked to her gender when she was threatened with rape and prostitution. And that would be enough for statutory withholding, at least.
Okay. Mr. Gayo, thank you for your presentation. I know you are appearing here through our pro bono program, and so I thank you and your colleagues for their pro bono representation. And Mr. Velchik, we thank you for your presentation, your public service. This matter is submitted.